Well, the book of Obadiah is the first of the minor prophets chronologically. Obviously, if you go to the minor prophets are 12 in number. They began after the book of Daniel. Daniel is typically considered to be one of the major prophets following Isaiah and Jeremiah and Lamentations, Ezekiel, and then you add on Daniel. And then what starts with Hosea all the way to Malachi are the minor prophets. There are 12 minor prophets. And Obadiah is not the first in that series. But chronologically, it's the first one written. So what we're going to be doing in our series on the minor prophets, we're going to take them in the order in which they are written. That's what our intent is here tonight, and also in the weeks that follow, is we want to talk about the minor prophets and the order in which they were written. The book of Obadiah, we believe, was written roughly 850 to 840 BC. So by the time Daniel is writing, about 300 years have gone by. By the time Jesus shows up, 850, 840 years have gone by. And the prophecy that we're going to be seeing here in Obadiah, we believe, is roughly about 300 years away. And then another part of the prophecy is even in our future. Obadiah is very interesting in the way in which it's broken up. You can actually divide or outline Obadiah in three sections. From verses 1 to 9 is the judgment announced. Verses 10 to 14 is the reason for the judgment. And then the last set of verses, seven verses, verses 15 to 21, is the day of judgment. And that's the way Obadiah is broken up. The first verse tells us that the author of this book is Obadiah. And we're told that this prophecy is a vision. This is the result of a vision that Obadiah had. And if you were to try to find out who Obadiah is, and you went to the Old Testament and you tried to find every occurrence of the name Obadiah, and you tried to find out if any of the men that show up as being Obadiah might be this prophet called Obadiah, there is no connection. So what it tells us is that Obadiah was a very common name, but we have no idea who the prophet is. That is, we know that he's called Obadiah, but we have no idea who his family is, where he was born, or anything. We just assume, because of the context of this prophecy, that he was probably from the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah, all right? So that's where we believe he's from. But we don't know anything else about him. That's what's kind of interesting about this prophet. If you look at the book has 21 verses in it, only one chapter. So that's the book, and that's who the author is, and we've just made the comment that it's a vision. So let's get into the text, verse 1. Verse 1 says, "The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise and let us go against her for battle." Now, it's rather clear initially when you look at this verse is that God is speaking with regards to Edom. And you might say, I mean, what nation is Edom? Maybe a more important question initially, though, might be is that where did Edom descend from? Like, who is the great, 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 all the way back grandfather? You know, I mean, like, where did they come from? Well, they came from a guy called Esau. I want you to look at Genesis chapter 25. Genesis 25 will take us all the way back. Genesis 25 will take us all the way back to the actual birth of Esau. And Esau and Jacob were born to a woman called Rebekah, and her husband was Isaac. So look at Genesis chapter 25 and look at verse 21 is where we'll start. We're told, Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. And the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? So she went to inquire the Lord. In other words, she's basically saying, why am I this way? I mean, like, what's going on? Verse 23, and the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb, And two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So right up front, we're told that there's going to be two children. And we know who the children are. They're Jacob and Esau. And we are told that there are going to be two peoples. That is, they're going to father children, and those children are going to father other children, and we're going to end up with children and children and whole nations, two separate nations. And we're told that the older one's going to serve the younger one. That is, the nation from the older one will end up serving the nation from the younger one. And the nation from the older one ends up being Edom, and the nation from the younger one ends up being Israel. And so that's a setup. That's what we're told. Now I want you to look at Genesis chapter 27, and I want you to look at verse 26 is where we'll start. And what this passage we're going to look at is all about is this is where Isaac gives, supposedly, Esau a blessing. Remember? Remember that Esau wanted to have a blessing. And he was supposed to get a blessing from his dad, Isaac, right? And there was some sneaky stuff going on. And mom got involved and decided that Jacob would get the blessing that was intended for Esau. Remember that? So look at verse 26, and we're told, "And then his father Isaac said to him, 'Please come close and kiss me, my son.'" He's actually talking to Jacob. He doesn't know this at this point. He thinks it's Esau. "So he came close and kissed him and the smell of his garments, and he blessed him and said, 'See, the smell of my son is like a smell of a field, which the Lord has blessed. And how may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and an abundance of grain and new wine? And may peoples," now watch it, "may peoples serve you and nations bow down to you, be master of your brothers. And may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be those who curse you, and bless those who bless you." Isaac says that your brothers are going to serve you, and that's Esau. Now if you look at verse 39, we're told, "Then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him," this is now Esau, look at the last part of verse 38, you'll see Esau now is in focus. And here's the blessing now that was given to Esau. "Behold, away from the fertility of the earth shall be your dwelling, and away from the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and your brother you shall serve, and it shall come about when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your neck." Now, these three passages we put together gives you a picture of the relationship of Jacob and Esau. And the message is that Jacob is going to be the dominant one, and Esau will be the one who ends up serving his brother. And it's part of the blessing that Isaac pronounces on the two boys, the two sons. But we're told in verse 40 something really interesting. We are told that Esau, when he gets restless, he's going to break the yoke. That is, there's going to come a time when he will no longer be subservient to his brother. All right? Now that's important, because that implies what? Conflict. Implies conflict is coming. So there's your setup. Now look at chapter 36 of Genesis. And look at verse 1. This is the part of the records or the genealogies of Esau, and we're given some interesting information in this chapter. In verse 1, we're told, "And now these are the records of the generations of Esau." That is, what does it say? Edom. So right there, if you weren't sure that Esau and Edom are interchangeable terms, right there you know at this point that they are. So Esau is the person, and Edom is the nation that comes from Esau. Now look at verse 8. "So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir." Esau is Edom. So again, we're told in verse 8 that Esau is Edom. Interchangeable. And also, and where are they living? Where will Esau and his descendants, or where will Esau's descendants live? They will live in Seir. Verse 9. And these then are the records of the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in the hill country of Seir. So if you weren't sure now, three times in this chapter, we are told that Esau is the father of the Edomites who live in Seir, and today we refer to it as the nation of Edom. Actually, they lived in the Negev. Well, if you were to look at a map of Israel, you find out that actually the kingdom of Edom actually was south of the Dead Sea and actually went all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And they ended up actually occupying a huge territory. I mean, it's fascinating, the territory that they ended up occupying. Later on, what we find out is that the Edomites are actually defeated by King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonian Empire. And later on, they end up moving into the southern part of Judah, and they become known as the Edomians. And there's a man who comes from the Edomians we know as Pontius Pilate. And interestingly enough, he ends up putting Jesus Christ to death, who is a descendant of Jacob. So there's your setup for our study tonight. And I want you now to go back to Obadiah and look at verse 1. Verse 1, we read, "Thus says the Lord concerning Edom, we have heard a report from the Lord, and an envoy has been sent among the nations, saying, arise and let us go up against her for battle." So what we're told in verse 1 is that God is sending out a messenger to all of the nations and calling them to come up and fight against Edom. Verse 2, "And behold, I will make you small among the nations. You are greatly despised." Verse 3, "And the arrogance of your heart has deceived you. You live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling place, and you say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth?" Now, at first, this may not seem really clear. It becomes really obvious that they have a pride problem because we're told the arrogance of your heart, so that implies that they have a pride problem. And we know what pride's like, right? We all have it. All of us have a pride problem. If somebody insults you, real fast we can find out that you have a pride problem. Really obvious, at least for most of us. "And you who live in the clefts of the rock." Now you say, well, what is that talking about? Well, if you look at the land of Edom, you find out that it's a mountainous area. Some huge mountains, in fact. In fact, some of the mountains are like 5,700 feet tall. Well, here's the slideshow for tonight. This is the entrance to Petra. Petra, it turns out, is the capital of Edom. And this word, S-I-Q, actually refers to this entrance. Look at this entrance. Look at the people. People are really small compared to this entrance. And this entrance is really long. In fact, the entrance to get into Petra is actually a mile long. And along this corridor, the cliffs go way up. And this gives you a picture of some of it. And once you get into Petra, it turns out that this is all sandstone up here. And what they did is they carved their places that they're going to live in it. I thought this was really a cool shot. Look at the colored sandstone. Petra was famous for its colored sandstone, colored walls. Can you imagine having a place to live and your walls are all colored like that? Here's the treasury. Historical records tell us that Petra was wealthy. Immensely wealthy. Kept their money in there. Petra's silk and the urned tombs. This gives you a picture of what Edom's all about. So when Obadiah is talking about Edom, you can think about Petra, the capital. I hope the pictures give you some idea about what is going on in this prophecy. These are real people, a real nation. And they did some magnificent things. I mean, it's incredible. They lived in the, watch this, the clefts of the rock, we're told in verse 3. "You who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling places, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? I mean, it's incredible. It turns out that Petra was located in a cavity-like canyon. And the only way to get in there was through a mile-long corridor. I've already made that point. And the sides of the corridor went way up, perpendicular. And the sides of it were often colored because of the colored sandstone. They just had magnificent buildings everywhere. Unbelievable stuff. Verse 4. And though you build high like the eagle, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. In other words, what God is saying is that the Edomites, they thought they were impenetrable. Nobody could defeat them because of the location that they were at. They were high up in the cliffs, high up in the rocks. The only way to get in was through narrow corridors, easily defended against an invading army. They thought they were impenetrable. They thought nobody could defeat them. Verse 4 says, though you build high like the eagle, and though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down. They did not think that any nation could bring them down. God says, I can. I know how to do that. Verse 5, and if thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave some gleanings? What God is saying in this verse is really interesting. Have you ever had somebody come in and steal something from your place? My wife and I, we've had at least two occasions that I can remember. One occasion we were gone, somebody came in and stole. The other occasion we were gone too, they came in and stole. I mean, we've had our place broken into, not here, it was in California, but we've had our place broken into at least a couple of times. You know what they do when they come in? They don't steal everything. They don't clean your house out, you know, furniture and carpet and lights and books and beds and just everything. They don't clean everything out. They pick only certain things that they want, right? Well, notice what it says. If thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you would be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? What he's saying is that normally robbers, when they come in, they only take what they want. They don't take everything. But watch this. And grape gatherers, when they gather grapes, they don't gather everything. They leave something. In verse 6, it says, oh, how Esau will be ransacked. Messages. When God sends the robbers and when God sends the grape gatherers against you, Edom, he's going to take everything. There is nothing going to be left. They're not going to be picky. They're going to take everything, and his hidden treasures will be searched out. So God says, when they come against Edom, they're going to take everything. Not just picking and choosing, they take everything. It's called judgment. God's pronouncing judgment on Edom. And you say, well, like why? That's coming up, verse 10. We're not going to get there yet, but verse 7. And all the men allied with you will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you. There is no understanding in him. Now, there's three kinds of people described here in verse 7. The first group is all the men allied with you. What's that? Your alliances. People who have agreed to defend you. People who have agreed to defend you if you are attacked. And then the next group is the men at peace with you. Who is that? Your neighbors. And then we're told, and those who eat your bread. And who are those? Those are your friends. You have your friends over to eat bread with you, right? I mean, some people have their enemies over, I guess, but that's not too common. And maybe you might have people who, you know, are allied with you to come over and eat bread. But verse 7 is very intentional, talking about those who are allied, talking about your neighbors, talking about those who are your friends. And guess what? All of them are going to turn on Edom. All of them. Verse 8. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esau? What God is doing, God is pronouncing judgment on Edom. And when he says that he's going to destroy the wise men. You say, well, what's that all about? Well, it turns out that Edom was on what we refer to as the king's highway. And caravans would come from Africa, and caravans would come from India, and caravans would come down from Europe, and they'd come right through Edom. And so Edom had a treasury where people could keep their money. And, you know, buyers and sellers could keep their money. Merchants could keep their money. And so Edom was like a hub. It was a very profitable place. Merchandise was exchanged, and news was exchanged. Can you imagine what would happen if you saw some people come from India, and you knew they were from India? Wouldn't you want to know what's going on? I mean, today we have the internet, and we have TV, and we have newspapers, but in those days you didn't have that. You just had word of mouth, right? Conversation. So people from India would come, and you'd find out what's going on. People from Europe would come, and you asked them what's going on. People from Africa would come, and you asked them what's going on. And so Edom became like the news center and like the financial center. Edom was an important place. And so when God says, destroy your wise men, talking about the people who knew, talking about the people who were informed, talking about the rich people, verse 9, and then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman. By the way, Teman was a major city in Edom. He says, and so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter. And what God's doing, God's pronouncing judgment on Esau. God's pronouncing judgment on Edom. And you say, like, why? And God's already indicated that because of their arrogance, they're going to be brought down. But the reason is given in verse 10. And look at the way the verse starts off. It says, because. Right there, that's all you need to know. Here's the reason why judgment is coming on Edom. Because of violence to your brother Jacob. God says, because you've done violence to your brother. You did violence to your brother. That's why this is going to happen to you. This is why the prophecy is pronounced against you of judgment. So that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter because of your violence to your brother Jacob. You will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. Now, from verse 11, 12, 13, and 14, we're actually given four different reasons, four explanations as to what the Edomites did to Israel. And I want you to see all four. Verse 11 is the first problem. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, and you say, well, whose wealth? Judah. Israel, the Jews. And foreigners entered his gate and cast lots for Jerusalem. You too were as one of them. So what's verse 11 all about? What's verse 11 saying is that, look, strangers came against Judah, carried off his wealth, foreigners entered his gate, and you were like one of them. And you say, well, but they didn't do it, right? I mean, other people did it. It's really clear from this verse the Edomites didn't actually do this because we're told that strangers carried off the wealth and foreigners entered his gate. So in what way do they participate? Did you catch what the first part of the verse said? You were aloof. What's that? You were indifferent. Oh, they're taking Judah's stuff. Oh, okay. You guys do it. I'm not going to help. Indifferent. You know, it's amazing here in our culture. You watch the news. Forever, you're reading about somebody who's getting attacked by a group of hoodlums, by a group of thugs, some people from a gang. And people stand around and watch it. Right? They just watch it. They watch the poor, helpless woman trying to defend herself when somebody steals, and everybody just stands around and watches. That's what Edom did to Israel. They just stood around and watched. They were aloof. They didn't really care. I'm not going to get involved. I'm just not going to do that. And the truth is, they really didn't care enough. But see, you know what God says? You were like one of them. I mean, you might as well have participated in the beating up of Israel. Or in my little illustration, participated in beating up this woman. You know what God says? If somebody's in trouble and you just ignore it, you drive right by, you walk right by, you don't care, you aren't going to do anything, God says, you participated in that. You just decided you're going to be aloof. You're not going to get involved. Too risky. I'm sure if Edom had gone down and tried to defend Israel, there would have been some people who would have lost their lives, right? God says, if you're just going to be aloof, it's like you participated. And so God says, you're going to get judged. That's what we've been told from verse 1 through verse 9. Because what we're reading now is, why is judgment coming? And the first one is that they were aloof when Israel needed help, when Judah needed help. Verse 12. Here's the next reason. And do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. You know what the Edomites also did? When Judah was getting attacked by their enemies, the Edomites, oh good, they deserve that. They deserve that. I'm glad that that happened. Got a question for you. Have you ever been offended by somebody or somebody hurt you? Maybe somebody stole from you, somebody did something wrong and you really got hurt. Or maybe you were in a church and somebody did something wrong in that church. Maybe it was the pastor, maybe it was a leader, maybe it was, I don't know who it is, but somebody. And later on, the church started having real problems. What did you do? Did you go, oh good, that church should have folded after all? You know what you just did? You gloated. God condemned Edom because they gloated over Judah. Keep your hand in Obadiah, go to Proverbs. I want you to see a very interesting verse. Proverbs 24. I want you to look at verse 17. Proverbs 24, 17. Proverbs 24, 17 says, do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles. Now, that's what happens to us, right? I mean, if you were cheering for the church that had folded or was losing attendance or was going through financial trouble or was going through whatever they were going through, and you were cheering and thinking this is really a good thing, look at the next verse. God says, you know, don't rejoice, verse 17. Verse 18 says, or the Lord will see it and be displeased and turn his anger away from him. So if you have somebody who has hurt you, who has offended you, that proverb says, and if you start cheering and you're glad, you're gloating over what's happened, God says, I'll stop chastising him. You know what God's going to do to Edom? The prophecy says they're going to be chastised. And it happened. So what we're told in verse 11 is that they stood aloof. Verse 12 says that they gloated over the problems that was going on against Judah. They did not like Jacob. They did not like Israel. They did not like Judah. And so when trouble came, when an enemy came against Judah, they gloated over him because of what was happening. Verse 13, and do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you. Do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster, and do not loot. There's the third one. They looted their wealth in the day of their disaster. You say, well, what does loot mean? They stole. So apparently what happened is that the enemy came against Judah. They attacked Judah. They obviously left Judah in a defenseless position, and what Edomites did is that they came in and took an opportunity and stole what they could. Think about what goes on TV. There's a riot, right? Some people get really upset. We had a riot this summer in a city called Ferguson, and everybody was incensed, and what happened? A bunch of people went in and looted. They took advantage. They looted while all this other stuff's going on. Well, that's a picture of Edom. So Judah is getting attacked, and they take advantage of it, and they go down and steal from Judah. So that's the third condemnation of Edom. The next one is verse 14. And do not stand at the fork of the road to cut down their fugitives. There's a fourth one. They cut down. And do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. So what we are led to believe here is that when people were trying to escape from the enemy, they prevented them. I mean, Edom really had it in for Judah. They were enemies against one another. And the Edomites wanted them to suffer. That is the point. I want you to think about something for a second. Remember when the Israelites tried to leave the land of Egypt? And they did leave the land of Egypt, and then they were trying to go up to the promised land. They asked if they could go through the land of Edom. Remember that? They asked if they could go through the land of Edom. And what did the Edomites do? They didn't want it. And do you remember from Deuteronomy what God told Israel to do? God said, they are your brothers. They're afraid of you. So go around them. And so that's what Israel did. I thought it was fascinating that here are two nations who are struggling with one another. And what God tells the Israelites, the descendants of Jacob, to do is to go around them. Why? Because they are your brothers. I thought that was interesting. Brothers. Can I make it personal for a minute? What about your family? You have family relations? How do you get along with your family? How do you get along with your brothers or your sisters? Is there tensions? Now, this is a great illustration because God told Jacob to be kind to the descendants of Esau. Why? Because they are related to you. God seeks peace. Obadiah is a great chapter. Obadiah is a great prophecy. Because Obadiah is about the brother who had it in for the other family member. Catch it? Edom wanted a family member, Jacob, to suffer. They were aloof, didn't go and help them. They looted them. They stole from them. They prevented them from trying to get to safety. I mean, the Edomites, can I change it? Esau hated Jacob. And it was obvious in multiple ways. And so what does God say? I'm going to discipline Esau. Watch this. When God disciplines you, He knows how to make you hurt. And that's what happened to the Edomites. Look at Genesis chapter 4 for a second. I want to show you another family squabble. Genesis chapter 4. This family squabble is rather interesting. One you remember. At least you remember at least the general idea anyway. It's Cain and Abel. In Genesis 1, we're told, now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. And again she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was a keeper of the flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. This is an older brother and a younger brother. Cain's older, Abel's younger. And so it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. That is, God wasn't interested. God rejected Cain's offering. And so Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. Now, get the picture. Here's big brother. He comes with his offering to the Lord is from the ground. The younger brother, you know, the younger one. I mean, how many of you have a younger brother or sister? Don't raise your hand. Think about it. Or maybe you're the oldest one. Have you ever watched family dynamics? What happens between the older child and the younger child? There's a rivalry, right? And who wants to be top dog? Older child. Well, the older child here, Cain, gave the offering. The younger child, Abel, gave an offering, and God said, hey, I'm pleased with yours, but not the older brother's offering. And so what does Cain do? Pride kicks in. And we're told he becomes really angry, verse 6, and then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your countenance fallen? And if you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? It's obvious that his face was obviously showing that he was unhappy, it was sad, distressed. And if you do not do well, sin's crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Basically, what God told Cain is, come on, get a grip, get a hold of yourself. I mean, it's a choice. You don't have to be angry. Anger is a choice. You don't have to be angry. It's a choice. And God says, there's this war going on. Notice how it's described. He says, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you. That's anger. But you must get a hold of it. You must master it. Most of us, we don't do a very good job of getting a hold of our anger. We give in to it, actually. Verse 8, and Cain told Abel his brother, and it came about when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Now, did you get the first part of this verse? Verse 8 is kind of an interesting statement. It says, apparently Cain went out and had a conversation with his brother Abel. Most of us missed that. So apparently when God gets through talking to Cain about getting a hold of his anger, Cain goes off to talk to his brother. And who knows what the conversation was all about, because we're not told. But Cain's still pursuing this problem that he's got inside, right? This anger against his brother. And after the conversation, probably got worse. So he kills his brother. Verse 9. And then the Lord said to Cain, where is Abel your brother? And he said, now watch what he said. I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper? Was Edom his brother's keeper? Was Edom Jacob's brother's keeper? No. Edom was all about Edom. Watch this. Edom was just like Cain. He hated his brother and he wanted him to suffer. Unfortunately, sometimes in our relationships with our family members, we would like them just to go away. We're not much different than Cain. We're not much different than Edom. Just wanted Jacob to go away. That's why God said he's going to discipline Edom. It was in God's hand. I find it really fascinating that God tells Jacob to be nice to Esau. And so Jacob is. Esau, in turn, though, is, if you don't mind, was mean. Use that phrase, mean to Jacob. They just did what they wanted. God says in verses 1 to 9, I am going to take care of Esau. I'm going to take care of Edom. I'm going to judge them. Okay, so there's a prophecy against Edom. There's the reason why. And I think there's a great illustration here for us to think about our relationships with our own family members. And can I push a little bit? How about just anybody that you're connected with? What's your relationship with one another like? Do you think we should be aloof to the needs of one another? I mean, do you think that's what God would think is really a good deal on your part, is just to be aloof from somebody else's need? Do you think it's really good to gloat over somebody who is hurting, who maybe did you wrong? I remember some years ago, a woman came up to me and complained because somebody was walking down the aisle and inadvertently bumped her while he was walking down the aisle, and she was greatly offended she got bumped. And I said, well, do you think he knew? Well, I hadn't thought about that. It's amazing sometimes how we respond to people. Now let's go to verse 15. Verse 15 is the day of the Lord. And there's this huge shift. And if you notice, it's not about just Edom, it's about every nation. So here's the verse. For the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations, as you have done, and it will be done to you, your dealings will return on your own head. So God now says, the day of the Lord. We've now moved into our future. We have moved into a distant future, and it's the day of the Lord. And God says that there's a day of the Lord that draws near on every nation in the world, not just Edom. In verse 16, and because just as you drank on my mountain, actually there's an interesting shift here in the Hebrew, and it appears that actually he's talking to Judah at this point. He says, all nations will drink continually, and they will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. So what God is saying is, you know, Judah, when you're in Mount Zion, by the way, Mount Zion is where Jerusalem is, or my holy mountain. You'll see Mount Zion in verse 17. What's going to happen is all the nations are going to come up, and they're going to drink too. Only notice it's judgment. Because he says, and they will drink and swallow and become just as if they never existed. That is, they're going to be destroyed. But on Mount Zion there will be those who escape, and it will be holy, and the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. And then the house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame. So there's your northern kingdom, southern kingdom. And people are always saying, are the 10 tribes lost? Well, not according to verse 18. But the house of Esau will be stubble. Now catch this. This is important. Otherwise, you miss the verse. Jacob's a fire. Joseph is a flame. And what is Esau? Stubble. What happens when you take stubble and you put fire to stubble? You get fire, right? Things get burned up. Stubble is just like hay and pieces of wood. So the idea is that Jacob and Joseph are like fire, and you get Esau and he's like stubble, and they're going to be put together, and the rest of the verse tells you what's going to happen. And they will set them on fire and consume them. The them, in this case, is Esau. This is Edom, all the people in Edom. And so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. What does God say? God says in the future, Edom is finally and totally going to be destroyed. So what we gather from this is that the judgment that God is pronouncing from verses 1 to 9 won't destroy all of Edom. Although today, if you were to go into the land of Edom, you find Petra is just ruins. So apparently there are some Edomites left. But God says, you know, Israel, you know, Judah, take comfort. I'm judging them now, is what Obadiah is doing. And then God says, and oh, by the way, and out there in the future, I'm going to totally destroy them. They're going to be totally eliminated because of the way in which they've treated you. Now, I think this is really interesting. You know what God does? Judah is suffering. Judah has been wronged. There has been this tension with a brother called Esau, called Edom. And you know what they've done? They left it all to God. And Obadiah is like, God comes along and says, okay, I'm going to discipline this brother who has abused you. And oh, by the way, and in the future, I'm going to totally remove them. You know what God's doing? God's giving them comfort. God says, I'm your defender. Remember in Romans 12, it says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. That's the way it should be in family relationships. That's the way it should be in any relationship. And God says, I will take up your cause. I will defend you. Verse 19. Verses 19 and 20, if you were to read through it, I won't take the time to do that. But basically what's being described here is the expansion of Israel's border to the full extent of what God had promised Abraham that he would have. That's the promised land being described in verses 19 and 20. And so if you were to take all the descriptions here, you find out that somebody's taken the land of the Philistines, taken the territory of Ephraim. And if you put all the piece parts together, it's talking about the total promised land that was promised to Abraham. And that's what's being described. Verse 21, "And the deliverers will ascend Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and the kingdom will be the Lord's." There's your millennial kingdom at the very end. So Esau, God says, "I will judge them. Vengeance is mine. I will repay." God will take up Jacob's cause. And then God promises Jacob a kingdom. God promises Jacob this millennial kingdom. So God says, "I will defend you," and then he gives him a promise. Fascinating, fascinating prophecy.